Hair. Okay. Sure, I look good for the recording. Really need a haircut. The last haircut I got was when I was visiting my mom's for the recording in Palmdale. Not quite the standards of a San Francisco haircut. And so I've been stuck with this kind of Q-tip look that I don't love. They really don't know what shorter on the sides mean, I guess, down in Palmdale. Haircut is due.
Looks the same since early.
I don't like what I feel like I'm about to hear.
I think you look the same as when we met in early 2000, probably.
How dare you? But thank you. It's true. I do look the same as when we first met in 2000. Exactly the same.
What year did you start there at Shanti?
I started as a staff in 2000. And I think we probably met a couple years after that.
Well, no, because I was at the foundation then. So,
yeah, but that's how I met you, right?
Probably, yeah. And foundation from 95 until 2005.
Yeah, so a couple years after 2000. Because I don't think I started working on that contract till 2002. I was a peer advocate before I became a manager.
The old days.
The old days. You know, I later broke that contract. I just split it in three.
What we always refer to as the collaboration contract.
The very first collaboration in San Francisco, the HIV Services Partnership. I broke it.
It probably needed a little shaking up.
We had just grown apart, I think. But we stayed
just
friends.
Not that into you.
We stayed friends afterwards. And we're still collaborating with them.
That's all right. I broke up.
You did?
In 2005.
That we still have, I think actually all three places, including Alliance, still has the remnants of that, that collaboration, I think. Well, maybe not. We do, though, at least. Now it doesn't have the fancy name HIV Services Partnership. It has the very rote contract name, Emotional and Practical Support.
Woo! And you don't use Reggie.
I don't.
Were you ever?
No,
you
Aries. Yeah, yeah.
Well, yeah, Aries, but Reggie was the precursor.
Oh, yeah, yeah. A lot of our meetings was about being the we were on, the CIS team or something like
Yes. Uh-huh. Client Information System.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's how I first met Flora and Maria.
Same.
We go back, way back, doing testing on Reggie.
Oh, Reggie. Let's see. Quorum wise. Oh, good. Paul, I can harass you. Paul. Hi, Paul. I don't think I heard back from you. Are you going to be able to be on that panel for substance user health this month? Yeah? Okay, cool. So you'll be on that panel then with Laura and Eileen. Maybe Laura will bring Ro. I'm not sure. Maybe we'll put Thomas up there too. Just talk about, you know, Linkage Center or other kinds of substance user support initiatives. Sound good, Paul? Maybe you and I could just check in beforehand. Oh, you're on mute. I can't hear you. You're probably cursing at me now, but I can't hear you.
Yeah, no, that's fine.
Okay, good.
You know, we do have to use some euphemisms for what's occurring at the Linkage Center.
I love euphemisms.
You know, we have a privacy area for
yes, privacy.
There we go. Absolutely. Oh, hi, Judy.
Hi, how are you, Mark?
Hi, Judy, how are you doing?
Hi, Paul.
But yeah, the Linkage Center is going great.
Good, good.
Well, very, very exciting.
Looking forward to hearing all about it.
Are we just missing membership?
Membership. Not sure what you mean by that. Oh, Kira, do you know if we have quorum? Because this isn't steering.
Yeah, I know.
We actually do.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Yeah, I forgot.
I'm not one to judge on those things. I literally did send this draft agenda at Saturday at 9 p.m. So
yes, there we go.
Not judging. Hi, Doc.
So I, Kira, I didn't hear what you said. Do we have quorum?
Yeah, we do.
Okay, then let's do some introductions. We'll start with Matt. Oh, he's got his mouth full. So how about Na?
Matt Gelmaker, council member.
Okay, go ahead, Na. Okay.
Na Lee, council member with Marin County.
Ken?
And Pierce, council member.
And David?
David Gonzalez, council co-chair.
Paul?
Paul Harkin, council member.
And I'm Chuck Adams, one of the co-chairs for this committee. And David's the other one. Go ahead, Mark.
Mark Molnar, council staff.
And Kira.
Kira, council staff.
Is there another David?
There's yes, two. Probably Dave Jordan.
Oh yeah, there we go. I'm so used to his face being there. So, Dave, are you there?
Yeah, David Jordan, council staff.
Okay, and go ahead, Judy, say hello.
Judy Martin from DPH, Medical Director of Southern Sioux Services.
Great to see you here. All right, then we'll, can you pull up the draft agenda for?
Oh, that's the minutes. Let me get to the agenda. Do you see the agenda now?
Yes.
All right.
Anybody have any questions, changes, order? If not, we'll approve that by consensus. Now we'll move on to the minutes.
All right, you all see the minutes there?
Yes.
Okay, you can see who was present, who was absent. Others present included Stephen Spano, reviewing his presentation, excuse me, our pro forma, and then the presentation review itself of HCAP annual report there and agenda item 6. And then we had no other presentation, looks like.
No, we didn't.
Yeah, there we go.
All right. And then if any changes? If not, we'll approve that by consensus also. Does anybody have any announcements? Go ahead, Mark.
Just a reminder that this month's steering committee and full council meeting are in person at 25 Van Ness in the 6-4 conference room. Thank you, Kira, for reserving those spaces. And my understanding is that 25 Van Ness is still a masked up rule, as it is a DPH building, except of course for drinking water and whatnot. Any questions on that?
Nope. Any other announcements? Okay, if not, is there any public comment? What? Go ahead, Ken.
Just Mark, can you give us those dates of those in-persons?
Sure thing.
We can't get ready in 15 minutes for those.
So the steering is going to be on the 21st at 3:00. And then full council is on Monday, the 25th at 4:00. And it's for 2.5 hours.
That's the one where I need to be at, right?
Yeah, please.
Yeah. Yes, please.
And Kira or I will, well, we'll include you on the agenda when it goes out with a meeting notice. I mean, we'll include you on the distribution list when the meeting notice goes out.
Okay.
Where are we at here? Any other announcements? If not, is there any public comment? No, the only public is Judy, kind of. And then, well, sort of. Okay, then we can go right in. You're here, so we can go right into the substance use services.
Now, Judy, would you like me to share screen or would you like to share screen?
I think it's better if you do.
Okay, so you'll just tell me when to move to the next slide. So for presentation review, you can go over the presentation how you see fit, but there's no need to go over the presentation as if you're delivering it. You could even just describe each slide. All right, so I'll share screen.
So I've never been at this council. I don't really even understand exactly what you do. I know that HIV is a very broad area that with lots of different kinds of funding flowing in. And that there, I knew there was a council that sort of oversaw how all that worked. I think Bill told me that once a long time ago, but I've never participated in it. And I don't really know what kind of information this group really needs from me. So I made a presentation about the current state of substance use services, and in particular focused on the overdose.
That sounds very appropriate, because that has been what's been coming before the council, the high numbers of overdoses during the pandemic. So there's a lot of interest there. So I think your instincts were completely correct. As far as what the council does, we have a mandate to provide prioritization of service categories and allocation of dollars for Ryan White Part A funds. And we have advisory capacity for use of city general funds and prevention funds. We also support the work of and the epidemics as well.
Yeah, great. Good.
All right. So we're on the first slide. Just let me know when you want me to move forward.
Yeah, just keep going. Next one. This is the outline I was thinking about, and let me know if there's something missing here. So I was going to just talk about the range of our services, not just treatment, but also others. And then the what Mental Health San Francisco has been up to, sort of, from a very narrow view of mine. I don't know if you need that, but it is affecting all our services in a way. It's helping them expand with Prop C money. And then I was going to show some of Philip Coffin's slides, unless those are already on the agenda. And he has data up to 2020. 2021 is all preliminary from the ME's office. It's not final yet until probably August. And then the overdose response initiatives that we've been working on, some of which involve the AIDS Foundation and some of which involve HealthRight 360 and, you know, other things that you guys are already involved in. So that was the approach. What do you think?
Thumbs up.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's go to the overview. Drug Medi-Cal Continuum of Services, and I put some numbers here. Maybe I should add the website. People can look up on the website when they're looking for places. It's findtreatment.sf.org. So we have, it goes withdrawal management, which is, we consider that fairly acute. And then after maybe 4 or 5 days, people are kind of surfacing from the drug, and then they go into residential substance use treatment. And the reason that's a common pathway is because almost everybody's homeless. And that's authorized now for Drug Medi-Cal. It's authorized using an evidence-based placement tool to see that if the person really needs that level of care. And so it's authorized monthly. So the state put a limit on the state to 90 days. But if people really need it, we approve more just with general fund. And some people only need a month or two. So in the private sector, people go for 2 weeks, you know, and then they go home and they go to intensive outpatient. So all of this is based on, a lot of it is based on people experiencing homelessness in our city. When people are discharged from residential, used to be a lot of times we couldn't do anything but send them to the street, which then they'd relapse right away. So we decided to create transitional housing that was tied to outpatient care so that people could move from residential to intensive outpatient or outpatient, whichever they need, and still have a place to live for a while until they stabilize outside of the residential program, like in the real world, almost, not quite. And those beds, because people can stay a long time, they can stay up to 2 years if they want to. The average stays pre-COVID used to be 7 months. So those beds are always full. The other ones are not always full. Usually openings in all the others, but those are always full. So those, if we need more beds, that's the kind we need. And then, so then we have seven, we're very rich in opiate treatment over the years, and probably because of the AIDS epidemic, because in the 90s, it was shown that methadone maintenance reduce seroconversion for HIV quite dramatically. So then all the very progressive minded primary care docs in the city started asking for more opiate treatment with medication. So we have seven of those. It's four agencies. Two of the agencies have two clinics each. And it has a very high capacity, almost 4,000. But there are a lot of capacity that could, I mean, there are a lot of non-used capacity, I should say. The capacity is determined by the state. Each program applies for what their capacity is. And it's pretty easy to expand it or shrink it. So we have about between 2,500 and 3,000 people at any given time in the opiate treatment programs. And under Drug Medi-Cal, what's changed there is they not only offer methadone maintenance, which is what they've offered for 40 years, but they now also offer buprenorphine under the same license. I mean, when we work in opiate treatment programs, we're allowed to offer, quote, other services. So for years, we've offered buprenorphine as an other service, but now it's actually paid for by Drug Medi-Cal as an opiate treatment program. So in other words, the buprenorphine is dispensed at the window, not through a prescription at the pharmacy. They also can dispense naloxone. In spite of all these open slots, we still have overdoses. So obviously, and we have the programs in the Tenderloin on weekdays. They have, if you get there by noon, you usually get your dose that day. So it's really considered, I would consider it a high threshold treatment. There's a lot of regulation around it, and you have to be at the clinic every day and for a while, at least for months. So we're trying to lower the threshold of that. And case management and recovery support services, some of those can also be claimed under Drug Medi-Cal, and they're kind of distributed throughout the system. And then there's a new contingency management pilot for stimulant use disorders starting in July. And it's specific to Drug Medi-Cal programs. Three of our programs are participating. I'm really interested in how that goes. It's something we've wanted for years and something that programs get cited for if they offer it. This is the first time it's been possible. Next slide. So what do you think? Is it okay to cover all the Drug Medi-Cal stuff? Yeah? Okay. So then we have all kinds of other stuff, that are just as important, like what happens in the hospital regarding addiction, and what happens in jail regarding addiction, linkages from acute settings to the community, how to support linkage with navigation, and then primary care docs can use buprenorphine as well in their practice and have been. Since 2016, Barry Zevin piloted very low threshold access to buprenorphine at harm reduction sites. It's syringe access. So we've taken that and we're spreading it, and including telebuprenorphine at Glide. I think it was maybe 6 years ago, we started an addiction medicine fellowship. When I say we, because the county gave seed money, but now it's run by UC, of course. Fellowships and residencies have to have an educational institution behind them. So, and the purpose of the addiction medicine fellowship, as opposed to addiction psychiatry, which has been around for a while, is to deploy primary care docs with that second specialty into our safety net. And it's been working pretty well. A lot of the FQHCs now have primary care physicians that are also addiction medicine specialists. It's a huge improvement. Next slide. So this is the recent legislation that I'm sure you've heard about. It calls for a lot of things that are interesting, expansions of behavioral health and things that were pretty aligned with what we wanted to do, but push us and fund us to do them faster. And it particularly focuses on those experiencing homelessness. I mean, the target population, really the highest acuity population that we target for this is people who are on the street and also suffer mental health or substance use disorder. And it's funded right now a lot by Prop C because that was what was available when it was scheduled to start. And Prop C, of course, is for housing and for people experiencing homelessness. So that matches. So it includes things like an Office of Care Coordination, which is focuses on intensive case management and access to all kinds of case management, navigation, and so on. New beds and facilities. And we're getting a few more beds now, residential step down through this. But in particular, what was clogged up was the mental health beds. I'm not going to talk about mental health because it's not my specialty, but just to know that a lot of the new beds and facilities are mental health. Soma Rise is under this domain of Mental Health SF, which is a drug sobering center that's coming up. And then there's the street crisis response team. That's a diversion of sort of behavioral problems where the police get called to have real professionals deal with it as opposed to police. And also expanded access hours of the access center. Okay, next one, I think. Oh, here's some graphs coming. Oh, and I have a blank slide. Look at that. I'll have to erase that. Okay, let's go through the graphs a little bit. You probably have, tell me if these are already been shown to the group. So this shows the reason why we're so worried about overdose. Total overdoses are in black. And look what happened about the middle of 2018. They skyrocketed. Opioids are account for most of them. They're green. And then methamphetamine and cocaine are also involved in some of them. And that's red and yellow. The blue bars behind it are population size estimates of how many people inject drugs. This is what Willie does, for it's kind of HIV prevention to figure out how many people are at risk for HIV, right? So these population size estimates of how many people inject drugs. Unfortunately, and 25,000 was the last one that I have on here anyway. Unfortunately, that's not going to give us who's at risk for overdose, because we're finding by consumer input surveys that a majority of people are smoking their fentanyl. So that won't be picked up by this survey. So we're asking Paul Wesson from UC, who specializes in population size estimates, to give us, do some analysis and tell us how many people are at risk for overdose. And that's another thing that's funded through Prop C. It's the funding is just going through now. Next slide shows the treatment and by primary substance. The yellow is heroin. And then it used to be the next was alcohol, which is the orangish. Now, methamphetamine is giving it a run for its money. Methamphetamine is climbing up to be close to alcohol. That's the dark blue. But in particular, and prescription drugs are the light blue. Look how they're dropping. And fentanyl is green, and look how it's increasing. And that's up through 2020. Next slide. And this shows how it's all driven by fentanyl. So opioid-related deaths by year and type. So type of opioids is what that means. So heroin is orange. Prescription drugs, as I said, are dropping. They're the red. But look at the gray. That's fentanyl. So you can see this whole increase since 2018 is driven by fentanyl coming to town. And this is, there's a huge racial disparity in overdose death rates. And the blue line is Black and African American people in San Francisco. And then the next is white, which is orange. And the next is green, which is Hispanic Latinx. And then very, very few Asian overdoses, like 2% or less. And then the next slide is the distribution. You can see that you guys are in a hot spot, Tenderloin South of Market. That's always been true, but then there's some other dark blue areas, in particular Bayview and other. So, and then, so those are the slides. And then next is some of the overdose.
Can I ask just a quick question? What is this dark blue area here in the bottom left? You see that?
Yeah, I do. I'm not sure. I'm not sure what that is. It's almost in San Mateo, isn't it?
Yeah. Okay. Sorry. Next slide.
And look it up there by the marina. Do you see that's up here? Up
oh,
there.
Yeah. Huh. Some surprising little outliers in these areas.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And this is kind of old, but it's still pretty much true.
Yeah.
Yeah, these geomaps are hard to make. So there are three main areas that we're doing overdose response, and this started in 2019, and I'm lead for it. So harm reduction, syringe access, safe supplies, like for smoking, and also naloxone. We wanted to keep up with the naloxone distribution since there are so many overdoses. This was, as you know, at San Francisco AIDS Foundation, your syringe access completely interrupted by the pandemic. And so had to start putting these supplies in lobbies of SIP hotels. So anyway, we have funding to increase all these things. Low threshold and treatment approaches also is something. So the way we did this initially, because we didn't have a lot of money, was to think, okay, we have programs who are already helping this problem and they're successful at it. And let's take the successes and spread them. So that's kind of how we looked at it. And we called our contracting partners and said, we'd like you to do this and we'd like you to do this. And so you know how the contracting process for such a bureaucracy mm-hmm. takes a while. So some of those contracts are just starting now in July 2022. Mm. But we started working on them in 2019. So we're looking at navigation linkages as well. Houdini Link is the kind of model for that. Are you guys familiar with Houdini Link? It's a linkage from hospital to community for people who have their medication starts in the hospital so that they don't drop off their opiate treatment medication. And then we have data. We want to use the cascade model like you use in HIV, mm-hmm. you know, the 90-90-90 thing. But we, and a lot of people have advocated to use it for overdose. So who's at risk for overdose is what Paul Wesson's going to tell us. And then we'll say how many overdoses and who of those people are, are in treatment, the at risk for overdose are in treatment on opiate. And this should be opioid overdose because the treatment is that's accepted by the NCQA as if it were antiretroviral treatment is opiate agonist treatment medication. So buprenorphine and methadone, and in some cases, injectable naltrexone. It's a much lower rate. And then of those, how many have stayed on it for 6 months? And that's considered, kind of like viral load suppression would be for HIV because it doesn't mean that you're fixed, but it means that you're on a good start and you can show that you can stay on it for a while until it's effective. And so it's a surrogate marker for staying on it long-term. So we're trying to do that and looking at how many unique individuals are on buprenorphine, for example, and on methadone in the city. And then how many at any given time, how many have been on it for 6 months. The 6 month rate is about 63%, 70 if it's methadone, in the 60s if it's buprenorphine. And the rate's about even for both of them, like, around 2,500 for each one. That's pretty high. It's pretty high for compared to other cities. Okay, next slide. And then I started giving some report outs, how is this working? I don't know if you're interested in that, but
definitely.
Naloxone Clearinghouse supplied over 6,000 doses to DPH programs. Every week it's higher. And they decided that every single program in DPH should have naloxone to hand out, not just to, tell somebody where to get it, but to hand it out. The behavioral health pharmacy ordered and supplied 12,000 fentanyl strips, and it took them about 2 weeks to do that. So people, it's really popular. Everybody wants them. So they're ordering another 12,000. and the safe use kits, is we're running into a little trouble with getting people to make those, because I think it was always the San Francisco AIDS Foundation used to supply them through Population Health, but but they're not going to expand that to the program. So Health Alliance might do it. And then I think the county is going to eventually take it over, just like they did the Naloxone Clearinghouse, and make kits and hand them out. But that's taking a while because of the contract stuff. Buprenorphine access and harm reduction locations. I remember Paul went to quite a number of those meetings. GLIDE offers that, and they have some MAT navigators now, which has increased the number of buprenorphine that get it through this. It's still a very low number, much lower than we thought. So we're talking about that contract and deciding whether we should continue it. I think it's because we have so many live prescribers. And then there's this drug sobering center called Soma Rise being created, and eventually we'll have an overdose prevention site. I guess a toe in the water is the privacy area of the linkage center, which we do have 35 surveys. Bob Hoffman did those. He used to work at the AIDS Foundation. So he's analyzing them now, trying to compile the answers in an organized way. And it varies from, we love this, my life is so much better, they're not asking me to move along now, to here's how you can improve it, put the tables further apart, you know, things like that. It's very interesting. And then what else do I have? Oh, yeah, I think next slide shows some of the stuff about treatment. So the overdose response team has started in August, already responded to close to 800, I think, overdose calls by now. And they have a pretty good follow-up engagement. This is deciding that non-fatal overdose is the very highest risk group, that whenever they tie it to the paramedics being called for potential overdose, and make sure that the street medicine team follows up. And then Bark Market, which is the closest one to where the heavy overdoses happen, Bark Turk is too, but Bark Market is closer, has expanded their hours now to afternoon and evening with a goal of 24/7 eventually. And they just started in April, and their first week they had 13 inquiries. One full admission, I'm not sure. I think some of the other inquiries are going to turn into admissions. I'm not sure how many of them. There's a lot of ambivalence. People come, they want to tour it, they want to talk about it, but they don't want to do it today. And of course, BHS Pharmi expanded their hours earlier this year. They're open now, instead of to 3:30 to 6:30 on weekdays, and weekends 9 to 4. And they also started, they noticed that people weren't showing up from the SIP hotels to pick up their medication, so they started delivering it, and their refill rate went way up. So they're going to expand the delivery service to high-risk housing locations, probably even permanent supportive housing. California Bridge Clinic, we gave money to expand. Houdini Link, we gave money to continue because they were a research project. What they do, Houdini Link, takes people who start methadone or buprenorphine in the hospital, and if they want to, pairs them up with a navigator who's either looks like them or talks like them, right, is congruent to their ethnicity, and also incentivizes it. So you're incentivized to make your first visit to wherever you pick in the community, and you can choose where you want to go. It doesn't have to be one place. And then you have incentives every time you talk to your navigator for up to 6 months. So it's a really good support for getting back into the community and staying on your medicine. They're expanding to the jail now to do that, same thing as they do in the hospital. And OBIC, which is our induction clinic for buprenorphine, expanded hours to match the pharmacy. They've noticed that there are a lot of requests for buprenorphine injection now. It's becoming kind of popular. So they've given a lot of buprenorphine injections, along microdosing too, because fentanyl is hard. It's hard to treat somebody who uses fentanyl a lot with buprenorphine. And I'm almost done, I think. Yeah, these are the surveys that I was mentioning earlier. And then what? Oh, then I have things that we found out along the way. And we found out a lot of things. Next slide. So one of the questions that always comes up is, okay, we're doing this in a safety net and at the general hospital. How can we, systematize it and scale it up so that it can be in the whole city and all 25 emergency rooms in the city? Now, the overdoses happen at, maybe the most of them happen at 4 or 5 emergency rooms they end up in. So it's not quite as big a job as it sounds, but And PropC is for people experiencing homelessness. So one of the questions that comes up is, what are we going to do for people who are in what you might call high-risk housing, and how to work with HSH on that? And what we found out is Hillary Cunnins, who's our new behavioral health director, she's also an addiction medicine doctor and worked in New York for a long time. And she's very aggressive about applying for grants. She encourages us to do it, but then it's a huge workload. Like today, I was at the Board of Supervisors. That had to do because we applied for a grant. That's a go. I had to cancel meetings twice. Like, it probably took 8 hours of my time to do one grant. So it's just, and I'm not even the one presenting the data. I'm just backup. So it's really heavy duty work, a huge workload. So we have to, scale up our workload to manage that kind of stuff. And I just wanted to mention that the 2021 preliminary numbers for overdose show a drop, which is really positive. We're really happy about that. We can't say we did it. It's very hard. We don't know. Maybe that's just a normal pattern of being infected by fentanyl in the city. Who knows? And that's it. So, yeah. So tell me, give me feedback. And if you don't think about it right away, write to me. Yeah, Ken.
In these presentations, we can hardly keep up with our own acronyms. So when we say OCIS or whatever, can you just spell it out
in sure.
Sound out so that when we watch, so we know?
That's a good thing. Yeah.
Thanks. And it is truly interesting how we weave it in with HIV and our role in advising on funding for that is kind of where we're coming from too. So any insight you have in how there could be better connections than there already are, as we know, we've got lots of good people on our council that are also part of your programs, but.
Yeah, I mean, the general thing is that any kind of substance use treatment is HIV prevention, right? For us, it's treatment for use prevention. So there's that. But also, I think one of the things that I find is that the people that we're seeing are high risk for HIV. So I think wherever we have harm reduction sites, we should offer PrEP, for example. And anytime we do these interventions, we should probably tie it to PrEP, have at least testing and PrEP. So the more we can make that kind of connection, I think is a good idea.
And isn't it true that PrEP is just very easily acquired?
Yeah, I mean, I think.
Is there any reason why we can't link that?
I don't think so. I mean, maybe bodies. So, and also I think that the tooling of it is slightly different. One of them prescribes buprenorphine, the other one arranges an appointment for the person to go get PrEP. I mean, so far I haven't seen anybody just write it on, you know, see somebody and write the prescription within 10 minutes. I haven't seen that. Have you guys? No, usually I think it's a visit to Ward 86 or somewhere like that that's facilitated.
I somehow thought it was much easier. Can others chime in? Isn't it fairly easy to get a prescription for PrEP?
You have to go through initial screening because they're going to want to make sure that you're negative, because nobody can just prescribe PrEP to someone who could potentially be HIV positive. So no, they have to go through screenings.
And yeah, there's a state law that they're onboarding right now local pharmacists in certain places to be able to initiate post-exposure prophylaxis and pre-exposure prophylaxis. Mm-hmm. The challenge is that they can initiate it. You can get the PrEP medication, and there's even a state program that will pay for it. That's tied into ADAP, actually. So people can enroll online and get 30 days access of whatever they need until, you know, they figure their things out. But the issue is it still is a medical treatment. It is still, they need to be monitored. And so the follow-up care has to be tied in somewhere to someone that is going to be monitoring not only lab work, but also HIV testing. Because the thing is that if you start PrEP and you are HIV positive, there's a possibility you may be mutating the HIV or the HIV will mutate because it's being improperly sort of medicated. So that's the issue with it. So it is easy to start. There is still some in between to continue on it beyond just the initial sort of like startup with PrEP after and post exposure prophylaxis.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions for Judy?
I see Thomas signed up, huh, to be on the call?
Yeah, he signed in.
Hi.
Go ahead, Ken.
Judy.
Nice.
How are you?
Good.
I heard you have a new staff person that might. Eileen is my old office mate, and I say old.
Who is it?
Eileen Lochran.
Oh, Eileen, yeah, she's reporting to Hillary.
No. All right, this is just news today, folks.
Yeah, it was announced today.
Very fresh news.
You look great, by the way. It's been a while. It's been before COVID, right? Since we've interacted. So.
Yeah, it's been a long time.
So, Judy, can you share you said most of the overdoses are about 5 hospitals in the city. Are they all in the Tenderloin area, or are they, what causes people to go to those?
Yeah, so some of it, it's not just where they occur, but where the paramedics take people. So they take them to the general, they take them to UCSF sometimes. Of course, St. Francis,
is there a reason you can tell us why not the closest hospital?
California Pacific. Not necessarily. There's a kind of a rut that goes to the general hospital because everybody knows they know how to deal with this. But they do go to other places. You know, when Philip gets the data about overdose, it does show like where the hospitals were. And I think he says, if you can work with 4 or 5 hospitals, you'll have a high impact. Like if we have navigators at those 4 hospitals for overdoses that are survivors of overdose, maybe that would help things. So the California Bridge is working on that. That's one of the things that we're funding.
You're suggesting it's better somehow to get the paramedics to take them to just a specific few hospitals where you can link them up afterwards?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that's what they do now. That's how it ends up. Yeah.
So thank you very much, Judy, for sure. If you can send this presentation when you update it over to Kira and I think by the week prior, sometime the week prior, so that we can make sure to print out and have enough copies for folks to have hard copies in front of them.
I might show it to the communications people because okay. I know they have a format for slides like with the logos.
For the logos and all that. Yeah, for sure. As long as we can get it by Monday morning so that Karen and I can make sure that's printed out in the office before we come down to okay. the meeting afternoon. That will be great. Does that sound okay with you?
Yep.
All right. Well,
nice to meet everybody. And
I appreciate it. Thanks,
Judy.
I got acronyms and I'm going to put the website in for fine treatment.
And you might have questions that are along the lines of what Ken mentioned as far as like, why aren't they? I think people who are familiar with the system know why they don't always go to general hospital, but that might need to be explained more for folks who aren't familiar with the, with why that is.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you much. Have a good rest of your day.
Thanks.
Take care, Judy. Thank you.
Okay, next is the voting on returning to in-person meetings.
Sure. So this is the last committee to make its determination. The membership committee has chosen to return to in-person. The community engagement committee has chosen to remain virtual. And so there's a choice you have before you. And keep in mind that your choice does not need to be set in stone. But we should determine whether you'd like to remain virtual or if you'd like to remain in person. And if you choose to return to in person, when you'd like that to occur. So discussion would now be open. Ken?
Go ahead, Ken.
So shouldn't this be something like a survey monkey to all members? Because not all the members of this committee are here. And yet we're making a decision that's going to affect all those members, right?
I think not necessarily. I think if you choose not to attend a meeting when something has been on the agenda, then you're choosing not to be a part of that decision-making. I mean, that's my own perspective.
That's hard.
I know that I'm a hardcore kind of guy. But also the discussion at steering was that we really want the committees to make empowered decisions about what's going to work best for them. Membership committee was just very hungry and open to the idea of like being back in person. And particularly they recognized that a part of their mandate was to interview people and that's better done in person. Community engagement felt like, just for in some ways for like convenience that they would like to stay virtual for now with the option to revisit that down the line. And so I think that last part is key. So even any decision made now does not need to be set in stone. Like you could choose to return to in person and realize, we actually like virtual better. Or you could choose virtual and realize whenever that you'd prefer to stay. So the conversation, of course, at steering also included the idea of, well, what about motions being made? This committee doesn't really do many motions. But when Sunshine and Brown Raker come back into effect, that is something to consider. And what steering has talked about was for those committees or committee that decides to stay virtual, they can make recommendations, but it's going to have to go to the in-person committee of steering for the motion to be truly approved. And so that's just, that I think is everything. It looks like Thomas Noble has raised their hand.
So yeah, are we all... Is everybody here part of this committee, for starters? Are there any people that are guests? No?
No.
Okay. Because there are six of us, we could actually end up in a tie as well. Am I doing my math right? Yeah. So just to acknowledge that.
Well, a tie would actually mean no. Remember, it's a tie plus one.
I don't know. I don't think I've ever been in a vote in a tie where...
So it depends on how you phrase the question. If you phrase the question, want to go back to in-person meetings, then implicitly you have to have four people. But if you phrase the question, do you want to remain in virtual meetings, then you have to have four to say you will remain. So how are you phrasing it, Mark?
Exactly. I'm not phrasing anything, but I appreciate the experience. Let me phrase it.
Let me then phrase it that we vote on how many people would like to remain in virtual meetings.
All right. Is there a second to that motion?
I'll second it. It's fine.
Okay. So then a motion on the floor is if you would like to remain in virtual. Thank you, Ken. I just love the experience, Ken, for sure. It's like that's how you have to do it, really.
And all right, discussion?
Yeah, any discussion? All right, so by show of hands.
Sorry, Mark. Those of you who don't live in the city, I feel like I want to give you the opportunity to speak, just because I know it's a commute, and I want to be well-informed as somebody who works in the building the meetings happen. I probably have the easiest commute, so I'm not representative. But Matt, or thoughts, concerns?
So I do live in the city. I don't work in the city, though. I work down in San Mateo. Any meeting up in the city is not easy because then I come home early. I leave work early so that I don't get stuck down in San Mateo much longer. So it just adds time to me, but I've been doing it now since I don't know what year I joined the council. It is what it is.
Okay. No worries. Thank you. I just, again, wanted to, and
I think Na spoke on this as well. If you'd like to remind folks what you mentioned last week, I don't want to speak for you.
Yeah, I don't live in the city. I actually don't live in the Bay anymore, so I commute for work. But a lot of my work I do remotely. So I come in as needed. But I'm also open to possibly trying out another committee as well. If however this vote goes, I'm flexible. So yeah.
Yeah, I would think that might be an option that as we find which committees are in person and which committees are not, that people might want to switch based on their the necessities like you.
Any more discussion before we go to a vote on remaining virtual?
Nope, not for me.
All right, so all those in favor of the idea of remaining in virtual, please raise your hand so that I can see it. We have 1, 2, 3. Oh, dear. Oh, it's not a tie, though. All right.
Thomas Noble, I'm upset with you.
Well, if I could just comment, it is a manipulation of how things were said, but it's also the reason why I said, shouldn't we ask everyone? Paul, I'm sure, were he here, probably would have voted to remain virtual, but he's not. But because he's not, we're not letting him choose. And there may be other members too, but we have done this, we have made this decision, so I think we have to live with it.
So all those opposed?
Definitely.
All right, well, so the motion fails, and which means that you will be meeting in person. So now if you would like to move, you just simply just email me, right? And there might be people who wanted to actually move from community engagement as well. It was unanimous, but there was like kind of there are feelings, I think, about like, so there might be movement across, which is totally fine. All right, so when would you all like to start this? I don't think this needs to be a motion. I'll just go with whatever the group feels. Would you like to start this in May? Would you like to start this later? Up to you all.
Why don't you tell us what the problems are preserving space?
Maybe what we could do then is Kira can reach out to her contact and see when space is available and say, and let us know like, well, it could be available in May, it could not be available until June. And then maybe that will help the committee determine. Would that be okay? Okay, yeah. So then that would mean then that May we'd have to have May still be virtual while we receive that information. Is that okay with everyone, knowing the decision is still to be in person eventually?
Yeah.
Okay. You snooze, you lose. You leave a meeting, guess what happens?
How often does that happen, though?
It happens. It definitely happens. It has happened before for fairly emotionally fraught things, like I'd say the merger of the councils. Yeah. I mean, there's different reasons why the merger didn't originally happen when it was first proposed. And part of it was who was in the room, and part of it was how it was proposed. Okay, well, that's all she wrote.
So next month we're virtual again, and then we'll take it from there and finding out when space develops.
Yeah, we'll hear back from Kira about when space opens up.
All right. So then the next meeting would be May 10th here at 3 to 4:30, right?
Yeah. Zoom o'clock.
All right. All right. Then everybody have a good rest of your day, and we'll
before we next close. Month.
Oh, go ahead, Ken.
So Kira, is there a way to resend out invitations for the in-person meetings, because they're all in the calendars now and you can't change it if it notes a Zoom?
Oh, absolutely. So I'll talk to Kira and Melina about that. I think actually Melina might have sent them out with the Zoom things, and so we don't want to lead people astray.
Right Sure. And you don't have, you can't change it, you can only say no, I don't want to go.
I don't think even I can change
to
it
a Zoom meeting.
Didn't do it. So maybe either Dave, Kira, or I will resend those out. Good call.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Anything else? All right. Then we'll see you next month.
Hey, everybody.